Just keep being polymathematical, everyone here.
Hello everyone and welcome to the EdTech Podcast. My apologies to all of you lovely listeners around the world, for my podcast output has been a bit tardy of late. First of all, I had the EdTech Podcast Festival a few weeks back. The festival went very well, thank you for asking, bar my friend losing the top of her finger and having it sewn back on. So a massive thank you to everyone who came on down. I went for a nap after the festival and woke up about 3 days later. Steph got her finger stitched back on, and so we are back in business. Yay! And sending out our surveys this week to see if people want a 2019 version of the festival and where in the world we might hold it. Having woken up from my nap, I then headed out to see friends and listeners at the EdTech Day at Oslo Innovation Week. It was heartening to hear how the Finnish are piloting EdTech schemes in collaboration with teachers, as well as hearing a very candid and frankly emotional panel on the trials and tribulations of being an entrepreneur. It's not all fun and games, kids. Back now in London, I thought I'd settle things down by moving house. So the EdTech Podcast HQ is packing up, painting, polyfillering and preparing for a big move to the sticks in December. The good news is, A, I'll be able to develop the ultimate podcasting stroke cycle training studio at the new pad, and B, I'll be back to London and travelling internationally as before, so I'll still get to see you all whilst keeping you updated on how my veg patch is doing. Given this crazy schedule, I hope you'll forgive the sporadic publication schedule of late. The good news is we now have a raft of amazing content from the festival, which we'll be publishing over the coming weeks. But before we go into this week's keynote, it's time to announce the winner of the EdTech Podcast Festival Pitch Competition. We had many entries to the pitch competition, which we then whittled down to 8 nervous founders tackling areas such as tools for maths and science, content for the Netflix generation, and tools for systems change and saving teachers time. Our extensive judging panel included investors, senior leaders in education, student entrepreneurs, and many more. For the whole list of pitch entrants and judges, go to our show notes. But before all of that, who won? Here's the chair of judges, Neelam Palmer, head of e-learning at Ashford School in the United Kingdom, describing first of all our runner-up.
It is such a simple but effective idea. It is what we call an instant win-win. Low cost, but so relevant to both the teacher and the student.
The runner-up for the EdTech Podcast Pitch Competition is teacher entrepreneur and first-time pitching. It's Mark Marley from Carter's Yard Phonics. Congratulations, Mark. And here is his response.
Hello.
Hi, is that Mark?
Hey.
Can you hear me? I just wanted to call up to let you know that you came second in the pitch competition.
It's really good.
Amazing, because if I understand correctly, that's the first time you pitched your idea.
Yeah, it is the first time. It's looking scary as well. But it's the first time we've gone public other than Twitter and stuff, so we don't really know what we're doing as much. But we're giving it a good go.
You're underselling yourself, I think. What's it like to receive the news and what's your reaction to the judge's decision?
I think it's just nice from our own point of view, really, that actually we're actually getting some recognition from sort of influential people and people who have been through the processes before. And it's kind of some reassurance for us as well that actually what we've got is, you know, genuinely a good product. Yeah, it's just reassuring, and it gives us a little bit of momentum going forward that actually the people like it and we can keep going with it. And what we're looking to maybe try and, because of we are full-time teachers, is maybe sort of hand it over to maybe some distributors, maybe get some investors involved in it who can take it to the next level, because it's just at the moment it's just a product, and what we really need now is some momentum and some people hopefully to drive us forward. Who operate in those circles that we need to be in.
I'll ask you for your address in a minute, and I'll send you a little prize in the post. Unfortunately, it's not a £10,000 check.
Yeah, if you can find anybody, Sophie, that will give me 6 months off so I can put some real time into the project, then I'd be eternally grateful for that. But that's not likely to happen either. But like I say, thank you very much. Yeah.
Next up, here's Neelam again, describing the winner of this year's Festival Pitch Competition.
From an educator's point of view, it is really important that there is a significant impact of why we're using a particular piece of technology. We are currently using Matagon in our maths classes at Ashford School. And as said by our teachers, the user interface is really easy to use, it is very intuitive, and both teachers and students find it very useful in their teaching and learning.
So huge congratulations to Philip Negner from Mathagon for winning the inaugural The EdTech Podcast Festival Pitch Competition. An EdTech Podcast mug is winging its way to you in the post, and here is Philip's response.
Wow, thanks for letting me know. Yeah, I'm delighted. I know that many people on the panel of judges have a lot of experience in education technology, and I was so excited that I had a chance to pitch to them what I've been working on, and I love that they liked it, not only from a sort of business and investment point of view, but also from a teacher and student point of view.
Phew! After all that excitement, it's time to kick off with this week's recording. It's our keynote from the festival, Dr. Jess Wade. Not only is Jess Wade a prolific past guest on the EdTech podcast and a researcher at Imperial College London, completing a postdoc on organic light-emitting diodes, but she's also an active advocate and outreach ambassador for the arts and sciences. Her current projects include writing well over 270 Wikipedia page entries for female scientists of prominence as yet unrecognised on the platform, including Professor Kim Cobb, Professor Kristen Grellman, and Professor Laura Hertz. She's also raised over £22,000 to get Angela Saini's book Inferior into the library of every state school in the United Kingdom to help support young girls navigate the science world with confidence. Why is this relevant? Well, only this past week, Dr. Jess Wade was at a gender and physics event at CERN, where a prominent physicist, Professor Alessandro Strumia, a senior researcher at the National Institute of Chemical Physics and Biophysics, stated that physics was invented and built by men, but sexist against men, in what looked like a toys out of the pram moment because he had been beaten in a job application by a woman with less citations than him. The professor has since been suspended by CERN, who have egg on their face somewhat given that Strumia is a well-known researcher to the institution. Amidst the same time frame, Donna Strickland has been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for Physics. Congratulations, Donna, and the first woman to do so in 55 years for her work in the field of laser physics. Bear all this in mind as you listen to this week's recording, which is Dr. Jess Wade live at the festival talking about the power of polymath, something close to my heart as I think about ways to bring together the ed and the tech, science and the arts, and the creative endeavour of weaving throughout. Here's Laura McInerney, educational journalist and co-founder of TeacherTap, kicking off with an intro to Jess.
Thanks, Sophie. I got the Mac introduction there because Sophie came to me earlier and she said, how do you say your name? And I get this every time I stand on a stage. So just in case you don't know, my name is Laura McInerney. If you can't easily remember it, you just imagine that there are two more of me. There is Laura, Mac, and Ernie. They follow me around everywhere that I go. Now, Sophie's just asked you to get hold of your phone to do a Tendify, and as much as I don't really want to disturb that, I'm going to. So I'm going to ask you actually to put your phones down for a second, and I'm just going to ask you to say a big well done to Sophie through a round of applause for setting up this very first EdTech Podcast Festival. It is with excitement and pleasure that we are here in one of the best places in all of London. It's where I taught and it's also where I live. And I'm so excited to be presenting to you your keynote speaker this morning. Now, every single one of us will have experienced at some time that horrible sinking feeling when you know that you're being stereotyped by somebody and they're being very well-meaning, you don't know whether you're going to say something to them. It might be, for instance, that you're a dad and you're taking some parental leave and you explain this to people and you can almost see the patronising questions that are about to come out. Perhaps you've been followed around a shop for the colour of your skin. Perhaps you were a blind child told that the only job you can do is become a piano tuner. Not only is Dr. Jess Wade an absolutely brilliant scientist who's done her PhD at Imperial College and is now a specialist in plastic electronics, not only has she won so many medals and taken part in so many different delegations abroad and done so many peer-reviewed journals that I can't possibly list them all in time, she also last year spent a whole year adding nearly 300 women to Wikipedia who had been pioneers in science and technology. Because the fact is, there have been female editors, there have been many female scientists, and those stereotypes are so often wrong. And yet too often people like me let people walk away. So just like science stands on the back of giants, today we will have our own giant on this stage. Jess, over to you.
Thank you so much. I made a mistake of sitting on the stage before Sophie began, so the whole time now I'm like sprouting up. Thank you so much for that incredibly too kind introduction. I'm not really that great, but I am here to talk about the power of the polymath and what I think behind it. And I think in your program you have some kind of description as me being one of these people who's really good at many things like art as well. But really when I look at my very short life and career in science. I started at school, spent a very long time at school. I went to art school before I studied physics, where I spent a very, very short time. And then I've been at Imperial doing science for a really, really long time. So the whole span of my artistic life was a tiny, tiny dot on this whole career. And during that tiny, tiny dot, I spent a long time making art of Pete Doherty. I was completely obsessed with Pete Doherty at the time. And this was kind of the legacy of my creative talents. But now I make really, really cool crystal structures at Imperial where we use them to make light-emitting diodes out of carbon-based materials. And I'll tell you a bit more about that later because I think that involves being a bit of a polymath in many ways. But during this time when I was an artist, briefly, I spent a long time in Florence. And there you're introduced to polymaths all the time, right? There's where this whole idea of the Renaissance man came from. And it was all people like Leonardo da Vinci who could do just about everything or seemed to be able to do just about everything. They could draw, they could make mechanical structures, they could build wonderful things. My favorite one is Brunelleschi. Has everyone heard of Brunelleschi? I spent a long time over the past few days talking to my dad about him. But he was a rich man. He grew up in a rich family. He did a goldsmith apprenticeship. He could do poetry. He could write. He could build structures. He could basically do everything. He could do needlework, woodwork, metalwork. Before the Renaissance, we had a terrible challenge in art that we had absolutely no perspective. So when you see all of these kind of weird religious paintings, everyone's standing on top of each other and there's no sense of depth and you don't know where anyone's actually supposed to be or what kind of people's heights are. And Brunelleschi was fascinated with many things. One of them was optics, and he had a series of lenses that he used to play with when he went into all of these beautiful churches, and he worked out how to give drawings structure. So he developed all these tiny little complicated opticals models to be able to put inside when he was standing in front of a building to be able to get depth and to be able to draw things so that you actually felt like you were going into a room when you looked at them. He also, on the side, did metalwork. He made the first portable clock. And then in 1418, Florence decided they needed a top to their massive, massive cathedral. If any of you have been to Florence, to this cathedral, Santa Maria del Fiore. I got this yesterday from National Geographic. I thought it was really cute. So Brunelleschi was coming along. He saw this thing. He saw this massive structure, this massive challenge. No one had taken marble to that height before. It had a massive hole in for centuries, for decades and decades and decades. And he thought, I know how to fix this. I'm going to do it. He had no experience in building these kind of structures. No one had ever developed a crane before. And he came along and said he was going to do it. And now, as many of you who will know who have been to Florence, it's one of the most beautiful structures in the entire world. And the cranes he built during that time are ones that we didn't beat until the Industrial Revolution. So I think this guy is really, really cool. And now we have these kind of horrible toxic terms, like you're a jack of all trades and a master of none. And I hear this so much when you speak to scientists who work in really interdisciplinary fields. They're like, they've not specialized in one thing. They can just do a whole bunch of things badly. And in China, I think it's interesting, it's equipped with knives all over, yet none is sharp. And these things are really damaging, because when you look back at our kind of top 20 scientists from modern times, all of them, well, 15 of the top 20, are all described as being some kind of polymath in one way or another. The one that I most oh gosh, I've broken it. What do I do, sir? Not a tech polymath, clearly. I fixed it. What a genius. So I think the thing that's really scary about this, I'll get to in a minute, actually. Pasteur is my favorite one. So Pasteur gave us milk, and that's what you guys all know him for, and he's super famous for that. But when he started his life, he was the son of people who used to make wine. And while he was making all of this wine, he also used to do loads of painting. And then he noticed in the crystals of dried up wine that there was this really weird structure going on. And basically, you have a molecule that's called tartaric acid, and it exists in these mirror image forms. They're called enantiomers. But they exist in these pairs where they have exactly the same molecular structure, but they're non-superimposable mirror images of one another. So basically, these non-superimposable mirror images of one another has given rise to a whole area of chemistry called chirality, and this sense that we can do things that are left and right-handed just like our hands. So even before Pasteur got to playing around with milk, he'd done all of these phenomenally different things that have given rise to a whole area of physics, chemistry, and biology. And that's just pretty sensational. So if we look at all the people now who we call a polymath, and we go through them, people like Bill Gates at Windows, people like Steve Jobs, people like Larry Page and Jeff Bezos, or even the ones in kind of England, we have people like Stephen Fry, we have just about every person who's won University Challenge ever. Bobby Seagull was a perfect example of someone who's a real polymath. And then I think about the people who are close to my own life. It's basically my dad. My dad is extraordinary at University Challenge. He's a medical doctor. He can do all of these phenomenal things. And the only lesson I can get from all of this is that the only people who can be polymaths are men. Because basically everyone we have from history is a man. When I think about the people around me who have all of these different skills, it's terrifying to think the ones that we really celebrate are the men. And then you look at the skills that we take to be these kind of skills of a polymath. So they're really, really highly educated. They can write, they can network, they're really into things like theater. They can usually paint, often they can play musical instruments. And the other lesson that I can get from looking at all of this is that only really, really rich people can be polymaths. When you look at the pages of things like why Bill Gates is a polymath, why Steve Jobs is a polymath, at the end of it, it basically says it's because they can read. It's because alongside their jobs, they like to read. They spend 5 hours of their day reading. And I think this is just really, really, really bizarre. So I wanted to work out, I wanted to think about it. Is it true that only men can be polymaths? And if polymaths are so great, if we're recognizing that these people are really important for society because they can have these multi-billion pound businesses, are we actually doing anything now that lets young people become them? In my kind introduction, we spoke about how I'm trying to challenge stereotypes, particularly in science. And last year, I read this phenomenal book called Inferior, which is excitingly on sale in the shop. But this is the story by Angela Saini, who is an engineer herself, trying to look at the origins of these stereotypes. Why do we give men all of this power by letting them be the only ones who are the polymaths? And she goes right back to Darwin. Darwin, our great polymathematical friend, who thought that women were intellectually inferior. So in all of his great studies that he did when he was out there proving the theory of evolution, he thought women were intellectually inferior to men, morally superior, but intellectually inferior. And where does that kind of thing come from? How could he think anything like this? And I guess because at the time that he existed, the time that he was doing this science, women were put in a position that they were inferior, right? If you look at something like education, Cambridge didn't let women graduate until 1948. Men could graduate in 1209. So it was 1948 when women first could graduate from Cambridge. If you look at something like networking, which is something else I think is phenomenally important for you becoming a scientist, the Royal Society didn't let women become fellows until 1946. So men could become fellows in 1600. Women can do it until 1946. That's terrifying. If you look at something like theatre, women couldn't legally perform on stage until 1600, but the first play wasn't directed by a woman on the main stage at the National Theatre until 2008. And there are so many women in theatre and in the arts. Women weren't present in symphony orchestras until the 1960s, although now in America it's only about 4% women, which is still really, really terrifying. And it only became legally required to test medicine on men and women in 2005. So in 2005, they made it a legal requirement to test all medicines on women and had to take 80% of the drugs off the American market. So all of these things that I learned about in Inferior are basically geared up to make women not be able to succeed like polymathematical men. And all throughout history, you come across lots and lots of women who are actually standing up and doing absolutely phenomenal things. Caroline Herschel is a perfect example. Her brother, William Herschel, who you may have heard of, is a really famous astronomer and was doing all of this stargazing and building of telescopes. But she was out there on a rooftop every night using a tiny telescope to watch comets in the sky. She was the only woman ever to discover two comets. She couldn't publish her papers with her name to the Royal Society because she was a woman. But she was so determined to get her science out first. She used to ride on horseback 30 miles to take it for someone else to publish underneath someone else's name because she really wanted these stories to be known. Another great example is Hertha Ayrton, who invented arc lighting, which was kind of the electric lamps that they used to use in roads to illuminate, kind of like lampshades outside. And she did all of this in the early 1900s. And she was so celebrated, so recognized amongst the scientific community. She won the Hughes Medal from the Royal Society, which has only ever been won by two women. One woman is my head of department at Imperial. One is Hertha Ayrton in 1906. She couldn't become a fellow. She couldn't even go to accept her medal at the Royal Society because women weren't allowed in. Her husband was a kind of rubbish physicist, but in his biography, it says he could have been a much, much more successful physicist if she didn't go out and try and do these things all the time. She was wasting her time, and she wasn't looking after him by putting his slippers out and making him hot meals. And then more famous ones that you've heard about now, I hope, but people like Ada Lovelace, who was Byron's daughter, who was a really early computer programmer, and Hedy Lamarr. So I think the lesson I got from all of this is that actually there were probably loads of really, really great women behind these really polymathematical men who were doing so much of kind of the heavy lifting and the actual observing and doing all of this kind of science. And that's what really frustrates me. And now, if we think about it, do we actually train young people to become polymaths? And I think this is what this whole day is about. And what's really, really frightening to a scientist like me, where we have to be quite polymathematical, is that we have all these options of different things that we can do at GCSE, right? I tried to remember all of the GCSEs yesterday. I probably got it entirely wrong. And then at A-level, at most schools, we say you can choose three of those things. You can choose two of those things when you're 15 that you have to do for the next 2 years. If you go to a posh school, you might be able to do four or even five. So there, again, we're coming back to this idea that rich people have more opportunities to be able to do these things, along with the massive cuts to things like music and the arts. That means that rich people are benefiting again. And then you go to university and you choose one, literally one of those subjects. So you've cut out all of those different polymathematical areas. And when you look at something like the Renaissance, they were the ones who invented universities. And when they invented universities, it was this sense that you can have a universal education. It was an education in everything. It wasn't special. We didn't choose one subject like physics. But say you chose one subject like physics, like me, suddenly you enter the world of research and you're required to remember everything else again. I work in plastic electronics, which is physics, chemistry, material science, now increasingly biology. And you have to remember all of that. You know, I work alongside chemists who are suddenly having to remember physics. Luckily, I'm quite lucky because it's easier the other way around. It's easier as a physicist to remember chemistry. But that's really, really difficult, I think. And then suddenly, when you're at university, you're actually told you have to be really good at all these other things as well. You have to be able to talk. You have to be able to get up on stage in a scientific conference in some other part of the world where you have no one familiar around you and be able to talk about the science that you do. You have to be able to write. You have to be able to speak a foreign language if you really want to collaborate with anyone cool. You have to be able to write how brilliant you are when you write for a fellowship application. You sometimes have to stand up and do a presentation in front of a camera or take part in a media interview or make a poster that's going to win a prize. So actually, you need some kind of creative, artistic side as well. And I think there are many, many pros to being a polymath in science. There are loads of great examples of this. There was this paper in Science in 2013 that compared all of 26 million different scientific papers and the contributions from different science teams. And they found you're about 40% more likely to be successful if you had a really diverse team of scientists from loads of different disciplines in getting some kind of creative breakthrough and doing some kind of really exciting science. And when I look at the science that I do, we work on organic light-emitting diodes. But organic light-emitting diodes are great. They're carbon-based materials where we print each individual pixel, and we can do cool things to them, like cut them in half, because each individual pixel is emitting their own light, and we can tune their color really well, and we can get them really, really thin. So if you've got an OLED TV at home, the reason the colors are so great is because the color is coming from the chemistry rather than any complicated filter. But there's a challenge in these things, in that we have to put a filter in front of the screen. So if you guys watch television at home a lot, you don't want the ambient light from behind you to distort any image that you get. And because we have a shiny, shiny electrode at the back where we're injecting all this electricity, we put a filter in front. basically, so the ambient light from these kind of strip lights comes through, hits that filter, becomes polarized in some way. It's actually circularly polarized, but you don't need to remember that for now. Hits off the back, inverts that polarization, and then can't get back out through that filter. And that's really, really complicated. We now have to design light emitters that can pass through that filter so we get really, really efficient displays. And when we think about doing that, we don't think, oh, let's just do that in a really, really physics way. How are we going to determine this? How are we going to design this? We think about all the different aspects of nature that are doing this really, really well already. And the best example I have, without going too much into the cool physics behind it, is the mantis shrimp. This is an example we've only learned about in kind of the last 3 or 4 years. They have these really cool kind of colorful shells. They also have incredibly complicated optics in their eyes that act as a quarter wave plate. So they see polarized light. They see this light that I'm trying to create just because their eyes are so intelligent. And when a mantis shrimp is in a kind of defensive mode, it curls up like this, and all these little reflective parts are reflecting one polarization of light. So this mantis shrimp has been doing these kind of structures that we're now trying to create in a physics lab for ages. But if you tell a physicist to go and speak to a biologist to develop some really cool chemicals that might be able to do this, it's really, really hard if you don't have that kind of polymathematical ability to connect it all. The other really, really cool example of this is a group in Caltech. You can read about this. They've just published this wonderful paper. But they were trying to create these structures for intraocular pressure sensors. So they're things that you put inside your eye to be able to monitor tiny, tiny changes in pressure. And something that's really important for these is that you can have a little structure, a little electronic device in your eye, and then be able to measure it on something on your phone or something, some portable electronic device at some kind of angle away from you. And what they wanted to do was be able to do this at all different kinds of orientations. And the ones that you have currently, you have to measure 90 degrees. So you currently have to have your little electronic cool device perpendicular to where your eye is. And what they did was study these butterflies, because in these butterflies' wings, they have these absolutely fantastic nanostructures that are spaced so evenly apart, about 100 nanometers apart, so about 300th of the width of a human hair. They studied all of those and looked at those structures and how they could physically have that and not have any kind of reflection. So they have angle-independent anti-reflection, so they're completely transparent. And they've recreated these structures now in these tiny, tiny little devices, so you can measure absolutely minuscule changes in pressure from all different angles and orientations. And this is so clever, and this comes from people thinking like polymaths and being like polymaths. The other reason it's really fun to be a polymath, and this is one everyone can agree with other than all the cool physics, is it's really, really hard to be the top one at anything, but it's really, really easy to be in the top like quarter at any different kind of thing. And when I speak to my brother about this, he really wanted to play for Arsenal, right? He was never going to be able to play for Arsenal. That's a really, really hard thing to do. But if we choose something like being really good at physics and being really into something like art, that's much easier to do. So it's much easier to be able to do two kind of niche things where you can be nearish to the top than be the one top person in anything. There are very few Premiership footballers, but there aren't many physicists who also have an interest in art. He's a medical doctor who's also interested in music. I think that's really, really cool. You can also connect different areas. We have this phenomenal opportunity now, and I can talk to you at length about why I think Wikipedia is so important, but we have more and more information than ever before, and we have more and more ways to learn it than we've ever had access to. And that lets you connect different things. My favorite example of this is, again, coming back to science, but it's these phenomenally cool epilepsy detectors and treatment systems. And this was created by a team of scientists, one of who's a biochemist, one of who's a physicist, and one of who's a neurologist. And they use the materials that I work with, so these carbon-based materials, to develop these epilepsy sensors that you can implant into your brain because they're biocompatible. They can sense really small changes in electronic activity when someone's about to have or is having an epileptic fit, and then simultaneously pump out a neurotransmitter and target that to the part of the brain that's having that fit. So this is much more effective than any kind of drug that most people take, much more easy to administer than the kind of surgeries that some people often have to have. And this is developed because a team of scientists, actually two of them, Roisin Owens and George Melieris, are married. It's just a biochemist and a physicist. And they worked with a neurologist to be able to make this happen. So I think when you learn these different things, when you hear people talking, when you get excited by things like this, you put things together in ways that no one could dream imaginable. I hope you all watch Big Life Fix. Did you all watch that show? It was this outstanding show on BBC Two, and you can still get the recent series. But they got a team of makers and engineers and scientists together for 3 episodes to solve problems that society was facing. And this example was really fantastic. You might have read about it on the BBC. But this is Emma Lawton on the right, who is a designer. She's a graphic designer. And she has early onset Parkinson's, which is really rare in young women. And so she has a tremor, an uncontrollable tremor, which is terrible if you're a designer and you want to be able to draw. Haiyan Zhang on the left is the director of research at Microsoft Research. So she's a pretty big deal person. She came in and realized she could develop this watch that also looks really cool, that counters that tremor so that when Emma goes to try and draw, you can counter the tremor in your wrist by putting in another vibration. And it's such a simple and tiny observation of something that you can have a really, really profound impact on her life and also so many other people. And that is about learning how you can impact and add something. I think that you can add all of these different skills together. This is a little quote by Stephen Hawking to make me feel like more of a physicist. But when you add different things together, you get to do so many more opportunities. Like when you can stand up on stage and be able to talk, you get to come out and hang out in East London on a Saturday morning. But you also get to go and do places and do things that you can never dream possible. My favorite example of this is Sharmadine Reed. I hope you've all heard of her. But she started out in fashion communication. She then worked for Nike and for ASOS as a kind of brand consultant. She launched a magazine. She was born in Wolverhampton, I should start with, because that was the beginning of her life. After the magazine, after Nike, after ASOS, she set up Wah Nails, which is a beauty salon in Soho where they do really cool nail art. You can come and see mine later on. And it was all driven kind of by Instagram, kind of by this realization that if you engaged with young people through social media, you could build your following hugely without spending a huge amount of money. She won an MBE for beauty at the age of about 26, so this is pretty massive and impressive so far. Then she suddenly decided she was going to get into technology, and she said she just attended everything tech, every talk she could go to that was tech, every conference that was tech, to make people think she was working in tech. So she did this really quickly. And then she set up a platform called Beauty Stack, which is basically the only technology platform that lets you book beauty treatments, haircuts, nail, whatever you want, by images, and then sells those trends, so sells whatever you're booking to huge beauty conglomerate firms. She realized beauty in the UK is a £17 billion industry that absolutely no one is entering in a kind of educated, informed manner. She is so sensational. At the same time that she was setting this up, she became a kind of journalist, so she writes for The Guardian on a Saturday now, and then she raised £1 million. She's one of very few black women in the world ever to raise a £1 million thing when you're trying to do a startup. And this is someone who at every single stage has just said, I don't like the way things are going at the moment. I'm just going to do it my way, and I'm just going to do this, and I'm going to get excited about this and do it. And I think those kind of opportunities come to you when you're willing to be polymathematical, but also super, super brave. So I want to end by saying, I think polymaths, we need them, because we are currently facing some of the absolute biggest challenges in the world ever of all time. Whether you have things like all of these crazy things that are happening in the environment just in the past week, right? We don't need people anymore. We don't need scientists isolated in science labs. We need people to start talking and to start convincing people that these challenges are really important to be worth fighting for. Whether you have something like the way that technology is completely taking over the way that we vote in elections, or something as big as solving all of these horrific problems with displaced people as a result of climate change, we all have to work together and start talking a lot more, and that's going to take a lot more polymaths. But I don't want to end on a picture of these horrible people. All of these books are really, really sensational, and they taught me about so many really awesome people who've been kind of standing up throughout all of our time and doing really cool things and speaking back. I'll tell you briefly about all of them. A Lab of One's Own is a story of women scientists in the suffragette movement and how they were really crucial there, but also crucial in teaching young scientists how to do science when all the men were off at war. Inferior, I've told you about, is absolutely brilliant. Roma Aguaro's Built is the story of structural engineering and the story of all of our different buildings. But yeah, thank you so much for having me, Sophie, and also just keep being polymathematical, everyone here.
Jess, thank you so much. That was absolutely amazing.
Wow, what a jam-packed episode this week. A huge shout out also to the sponsors that helped the festival become reality, namely Cambridge Assessment, Century Tech, Learn It, PyTop, Lego Education, Cooley LLP, Navitas Ventures, Here East, and the London Legacy Development Corporation. Also to our speakers and media partners, volunteers, and all those who attended. If you're listening in and you like the show or have a comment on each episode, drop us a voicemail via the website. We'd love to know who you are and how you listen in. Have a great week.